You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Record on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in this week for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at how Wisconsin colleges and the State Department of Justice are working to fight campus sexual assault.
First, fantasy readers have had a great summer. There was the final installment of Deborah Harkness' Discovery of Witches trilogy, now the third installment in the Magician's trilogy by Lev Grossman.
The third book in the series is called The Magician's Land and debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It's also being adapted into a TV show for the Sci-Fi Channel. The series tells the story of a young magician named Quentin Coldwater, who has a series of adventures after attending a school for magic in New York.
Lev Grossman joins us now. He's the book critic for Time Magazine and the author of five novels, including the best-selling The Magician's Trilogy. Lev, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So, Lev, first of all, congrats on your big debut. The Magician's Land, the third installment in your trilogy, debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. That's huge.
That was an exciting moment, I can tell you. I had a side bet with a friend of mine that it would be number five, but obviously that was a bet that I lost.
What did you do when you heard the news?
Let's see. I was in a cab in L.A., and I didn't have anybody to talk to, so I told the cab driver about it. And we had a long conversation about it. He was happy for me.
Well, for listeners who haven't read the first couple of books, set it up for us. What is The Magician's Trilogy about?
Well, I started writing it almost 10 years ago. And at the time, I was a big fantasy fan. I had always loved the Chronicles of Narnia and the Philip Pullman books and the Harry Potter books. But I was aware that as I was getting older, my life was starting to look very different from the lives of these books, which were about children who were finding out they had magic powers. And I began to wonder if it would be possible to write a story like that about somebody who was discovering that they had power they didn't know that they had, but write it about someone more like me in a way that kind of reflected some of the adult problems that I was struggling with. So the hero, it's about the education of a magician, and the hero is named Quentin. He goes to a magic school, but his life becomes complicated in ways that sort of Harry Potter's aren't.
Well, before I read your books, people did describe them to me as Harry Potter for grown-ups. How do you feel about that comparison?
Well, like I said, I'm a huge Harry Potter fan, so to the extent that it's true, which is hard for me to judge, I love it. I've embraced. I think in some ways of The Magicians as being something for, I mean, a whole generation at this point has been raised on Harry Potter. And as they go from their the teens into their 20s and 30s, if they're looking for a fantasy that sort of deals with the realities of their lives now, The Magicians might be something for them to pick up.
Well, for you, writing fantasy, you describe it as an awakening. Fantasy was where you found your voice as a writer. Even though you've already published novels, why did it take you so long?
Well, that's a good question. And as with most things, I blame my parents. I grew up in a very, very literary household. My parents were both English professors. My father was a very successful poet. My mom was a novelist. Becoming a writer was in some ways an obvious choice for me, but in some ways it was challenging. It's only because there were already some very powerful voices in my family, and finding my voice was something that took me a lot longer, I think, than it finds most writers. And when I found it, it was in an area that I think was something very separate from what my parents did. And it was even a little bit of a rebellion against them, writing fantasy. Fantasy wasn't entirely, I think, a respectable genre to them.
And did you have to give up anything to write fantasy? I mean, here you are, you're the book critic at Time Magazine. You probably have aspirations for grandeur. Did you give any of that up or no?
Well, it's a different kind of thing. Our culture, our literary culture, places a different kind of value on fantasy than it does on, for example, literary fiction. So when you write fantasy, you know that you will never win a Pulitzer or a National Book Award or any of that kind of thing. Those kinds of honors sort of aren't for you. So in a sense, I was giving those up to the extent that I was ever going to win a Pulitzer, which was pretty unlikely. I was embracing a different kind of literary world. The fantasy world is different from the literary world, but it definitely has its rewards.
Well, the characters in your book, they undergo real trials. There's death, there's destruction, there's a lot of loss. all the kind of rough things that happen in real life. These happen side by side with magic. The end of book two, I have to say, was particularly traumatic for me personally as a reader. Did you want to bring some grit to your story along with all of the magic?
I guess you could say grit. I felt as though, when I read Harry Potter and Narnia and those books, and I still do reread them, they deliberately, choose not to deal with some adult realities. I needed fantasy novels that did, and that deal with, yes, with loss, death, disappointment, depression, complicated, disastrous relationships, even sexual violence. I wanted the world of the magicians to be a fantastical world. That gives a fantasy fan everything they want. But I also wanted it to look a lot more like our world. And in that respect, I was influenced a lot by George R. R. Martin, who, Westeros is a fantasy world, but it's not the kind of world you'd want to escape into necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's got some very harsh realities in it.
That's part of what George R. R. Martin is known for, is doing things that are unthinkable to his characters, but he says this is what happens in real life. He had to make it realistic. Is that the same sort of philosophy that you ascribe to?
Very much. The older I got, the harder I found it to believe in some of the fantasies that I was reading. And I felt as though I had to push back at them and transform them and make them look more like the world than I lived in. The magicians, it's about magic, but it's not cute, and it's not all happy. And there are some really scary problems in there that magic just isn't going to solve.
Well, you're not just a writer, as we said. You're a book critic, the book critic for Time magazine. How do you shut off the voice of Lev Grossman, the book critic, when you're writing and allow yourself to write crappy first drafts and things that might make you more vulnerable as a writer?
I do have to, because my first drafts are extremely crappy. I've been writing fiction for a long time. I started writing in college. I'm 45 now, so that's a full quarter century. The reviewer and book critic arrived later in my career, and when it's time to write fiction, that guy goes away. I don't know where he goes, but he leaves the room because you're right, it would be impossible for me to write a first draft with him looking at me with his judging eyes. he has to turn away and go somewhere else.
Well, your books have been optioned as a TV show for the Sci-Fi Channel. Any plans to help write it or help work on it?
Well, so far, my title in the Magicians TV show production is, I think, creative consultant, which means that I get to give my opinion about everything, but nobody especially has to listen to me. I'm interested in what the guys are doing. I watch the people who are writing the screenplays carefully, because I'm interested in doing that in the future. But at this point, it's their show. These are people who know how to make TV shows. I barely know how to make novels. I'm gonna let the professionals, do their jobs.
Gotcha. Well, for your characters in your Magicians trilogy, the fictional and the magical, they get intertwined and become real. So I want to ask you, you referenced your love of fantasy reading. If you could disappear forever into your favorite fantasy book, excluding your own, which one would it be?
Oh, gosh. I don't think you can top Narnia. Narnia, it's just... obviously, the wine there is excellent. People seem to really enjoy it, so there's that going on. But things turn out well in Narnia. Although, I say that in the last book of the series, things really fall to pieces in Narnia. So maybe that's not the right one. Maybe Hogwarts would be better. You have to pick carefully when you're choosing your fantasy worlds.
Yeah, it's a tough call. Well, Lev, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking to Lev Grossman, the book critic for Time magazine and the author of 5 novels, including the best-selling Magician's trilogy. The latest one is just out. It's called The Magician's Land.
The problem of sexual assault on college campuses remains a persistent issue in the nation. And while we don't often like to think about it, it's also a problem here in Wisconsin.
To that end, the State Department of Justice is rolling out some new efforts in order to protect incoming college students from sexual assault and to help those who've already experienced assault. And new proposed federal legislation aimed at fighting campus violence could also be on the way, too.
Joining us now is Carmen Hotvet. She's a violence prevention specialist with University Health Services at UW-Madison. Carmen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
We know that sexual assault on college campuses is a huge problem, but can you give us some statistics that really put it into perspective?
Sure. So some of the best data we have, wherein researchers have looked at large institutions and asked students behaviorally specific questions like, have you ever experienced someone touching you sexually without your consent? Rather than the question, have you ever been sexually assaulted, let us know that roughly 20 to 25% of college-age women experience sexual victimization between the time they enter college and the time they leave. So that's really a very age-specific demographic. We also know that men experience sexual victimization in their collegiate experiences as well. So it's a huge problem. And then on the other side of that, we know that many students have lots of misinformation about these crimes and feel disempowered about what they can do or scared to think about it happening to them. And so we have an obligation as college campuses to provide a safe learning environment that supports a safe response to these issues.
And I think you bring up an interesting point right off the bat there, that when we think about sexual assault, you know, we might think of the more violent or extreme versions of that. But how do you define it? What are those, you know, inappropriate touching, or, you know, what is the range of issues that fall under the umbrella of sexual assault?
Sure. So sexual assault is really any form of sexual contact without consent. So that can include kind of inappropriate sexual touching in public places up to penetration without consent. And lots of people think that overt force or physical violence is used in most of those cases. And at least among the college population, what we know is that the violence itself is the sexual violence. It's the taking advantage of someone's body. It's not necessarily a weapon involved or overt physical mm-hmm. violence beyond the coercion and lack of consent.
How much of it do you suppose goes unreported?
Well, based on a series of other kind of good research data, we know that roughly 2 to 13% of college-age women report to either law enforcement or a campus official. So most sexual violence on college campuses go unreported for all sorts of reasons.
Once something does go reported, or once you even have a suspect name, for example, on average, how many people may have been victimized by that perpetrator?
Dr. David Lisak is kind of the forerunner research in this area, and his research really looked at almost 2,000 college-age men and asked them a series of questions that would indicate perpetration. And based on his research, he found a couple of interesting things. He found he debunked the idea that just because 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 college-age women experience sexual assault, it doesn't mean that 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 college-age men perpetrate that. He really did find that only about 6% of the men in his studies, and his studies have largely been duplicated with other similar sample sizes, that about 6% of college-age men perpetrate, and a little under 4% of them serial perpetrate. And in his study, found that on average, they had perpetrated 6 times by the time they completed participation in this study. Mm-hmm. So what we know is we have a small group of college-age men perpetrating repeatedly and serially.
Well, the State Department of Justice has already made let's take a step back and talk about what Attorney General Van Hollen announced yesterday. Why don't you bring us up to speed there?
Sure. So I just have a statement right here in front of me, and it highlights a few things. One, that campuses are welcoming students back, that the national attention to sexual violence highlights our needs as college campuses to be more forward-thinking in how we prevent them, respond to victims, and hold perpetrators accountable. And what part of what his statement really indicates is that they are working to ensure that the crime labs are testing the evidence that the medical forensic exam evidence that may be collected, whether or not the survivor chose to provide a name. And it's a trend that's happening all across the country, that testing anonymous, what people colloquially call rape kits, and they're really forensic exam kits, can help link serial perpetrators even when you don't have an individual police report, because of the DNA evidence included in those kits.
So it sounds like what would happen is if a sexual crime is committed, the evidence is taken and stored in the state crime lab. And but what if the victim chooses not to press charges? What happens?
So victims really don't press charges. The DA would choose to press charges based on the evidence provided to them from the police agency. So what the testing options provided by the state crime lab allow that a survivor who might choose to utilize their local SANE program, they could report at that point in time. And federal law also says that they can get a free forensic exam, or one at no cost, without choosing to report to law enforcement. So you can get a free forensic exam and wellness check at your local SANE program without cost, even if you choose not to engage law enforcement. But then what happens with that is the kit goes, without the survivor name on it, to a storage facility. And so that's the strategy to attempt to not only go after the people who have assaulted people who choose to report, and it's also the people who choose to have gotten help and had some forensic evidence collection regardless of their choice to work mm-hmm. with police at that time.
Is there a backlog of cases of those that are being charged or tried? You know, what's the caseload for the state with regards to sexual assault?
Sure. I don't have specific data about the backlog, or if there is a backlog here mm-hmm. in Wisconsin. And my expertise is really specific to college-age students. And what we know is most college-age students don't actually choose to report to police directly. And though many of them do choose to utilize their local SANE program and have forensic evidence collected without their name attached to that.
Well, state officials are going to be rolling out new training for students and for college staff and for police across the state to help them find and help victims of sexual assault. Do you know what that training will look like?
I don't know what that will look like, but what I can say is that part of some of the federal changes that have happened are now requiring college campuses to be doing a couple of new things. And some of those are to provide primary prevention, or prevention of sexual violence before it happens, to incoming students. That includes undergraduate students, it includes graduate and professional students, and new employees. Title IX is now also requiring training of employees to know their obligations to report information once they have information from survivors or knowledge of sexual violence on the campus, even if that wasn't a survivor disclosure, and increased training requirements and standards for the people who investigate those allegations once they've been escalated.
And before we go to news in a few minutes, I'm curious what you believe is the key to preventing sexual assault. I'm sure that that's a multifaceted answer. So, but what do you think is, at the heart of cutting down the number of sexual assaults on campuses?
That's a great question. It is a multifaceted answer, and so I can bullet point out a few things for you.
And we can pick it up after the news, too.
So one of those is believing that sexual violence and forms of gender-based violence are preventable, that they aren't just a natural consequence of being humans or boys just being boys, or that would be a key piece. And working to change some of our social norms that put those things into place. And so the social norm of blaming victims for their own victimization. So that's one piece. We can work to prevent it by believing it's preventable. We can also support survivors who are largely still not supported in systems responses in this nation. And we've made great headway. We're a lot further along than we were 20 years ago, but that we need to support survivors and their autonomous ability to make decisions for themselves. We need to hold perpetrators accountable in our criminal justice systems and our campus disciplinary systems. And then as a community, really need to commit with the ongoing awareness strategies to commit to a campus, in my case, a campus environment that does not tolerate sexual violence.
And real briefly in our last minute before news, what are some campaigns that college campuses have successfully done to raise that awareness?
Sure. The best campaigns are really when awareness is tied to policy outcomes. And so it's not just a couple of posters that get put up in hopes that students would change attitudes or behavior, that it's also really tied to how the institution is responding. And so a great thing UW-Madison has done in the past few years is implement the responsible action guidelines, which indicate that victims of sexual assault or other violent crimes would not be subject to campus disciplinary actions if they were drinking underage at the time of an assault. And this has really reduced a barrier to students who were scared to seek help after drinking underage and they had been victimized.
I see. We're talking with Carmen Hotvedt with the University Health Services at UW-Madison about campus sexual assault, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Carmen Hotvedt. She's a violence prevention specialist with University Health Services at UW-Madison about what's being done to fight sexual assault on college campuses. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you're a student, what would make you feel more safe on campus? If you're a parent of a student, are you worried about your child's safety on campus? And what do you think can be done to stop sexual assault on college campuses? Let us know at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Carmen, much of the time the discussion about reducing sexual assault revolves around telling women what to do in order to reduce their risk or to how to protect themselves. Now it seems like there's a shift toward educating men as well about what constitutes abuse and stressing the importance of not doing it. Talk more about that.
Sure. So I think it probably rings true for folks who were in college prior to about 1995 that what used to constitute sexual assault prevention was really giving women rape whistles, maybe a self-defense class that had nothing to do with the realities of sexual violence and tell them to not walk alone. And though those may be decent public safety tips, and we all should take whatever strategies we would like to take to enhance our own safety, one of the realities of sexual violence is 9 out of 10 times it's committed by someone you know. So how likely is it to use a rape whistle when you're having a consensual makeout that gets pushed too far? Or when, what happens if the person who chooses to walk you ask to walk you home on the lakeshore path as at Madison, actually has put you into a vulnerable position. And so the shift has really been away from really targeting only women to think about sexual violence, and to not only think about or blame men when we know that very few men, in fact, commit serial perpetration on college campuses, but to engage the entire campus community. And that means looking at gender norms and harmful and hegemonic masculinity. And some of that work has been really exciting and energizing across college campuses. One of the things we do out of University Health Services and through the School of Social Work is sponsor a 2-credit class for fraternity men who are emerging leaders in their fraternities to engage their own communities and their own ideas of masculinity. And so thinking about the relationship between homophobia and violence against women, about their own empathy for rape victims. They sometimes have very misconstrued notions about what sexual violence is, that it's a stranger in the bush, it replicates some sort of mythos about racism in the United States. And that the effort is really to help them engage in their own self-reflection about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a man that isn't defined by what a woman is not, and that gender exists across a spectrum, and then how they can use that internal reflection to build upon leadership skills in their own all-male groups.
And how do you get these leaders to engage in that dialogue without, let me put it this way, how do you have that conversation without the other person rolling their eyes?
Sure. So part of what I'm really proud of in the End Violence on Campus office that I helped to manage at University Health Services is that work is really deep, and it's about the relationship among the men and the relationship among their facilitators to them. So it's not a one-time conversation. It's an ongoing relationship that engages their whole self as a person on the campus and a student on the person with other men. And asking them to think about the difficult ways that gender has boxed them in as well, that harmful masculinity hurts men and women. And in fact, we see this play out in sexual violence as well, that men who are experiencing sexual violence almost always experience that at the hands of another man. whether or not that's when they're younger and or when they're older, oftentimes, because it's a form of gender policing. So men who are gay or perceived to be gay are often more likely to be the subject of sexual violence, stranger sexual violence in particular.
Hmm. We talked before the news about, you said one of the keys to preventing sexual assault is to also support the survivors. And I'm wondering what, you know, the justice system and the Department of Justice, as we're seeing AG Van Hollen getting involved in this discourse, what can they do to ensure that victims are being supported?
That's a great question. And when so few survivors actually choose to go to police or to a campus law enforcement agency. So when they do, it's of utmost importance that those agencies are trained by local victim service providers, that they've listened to victims before, that they're acknowledging that trauma may present very differently for very different people. And so that might mean doing the interview in multiple sections. A best practice would be to always invite the survivor to have a support person or victim advocate with them, to informing them of their rights and their ability to progress at a pace that works for them, and then being transparent about what those processes are.
And obviously each situation is different, but are there certain patterns that we can learn from?
In terms of how perpetration happens?
Yes.
Or
mm-hmm.
One of the things that came out of Dr. Lisak's kind of groundbreaking research really is that on college campuses, alcohol is almost always involved in how predators make victims vulnerable. That does not mean alcohol causes sexual violence. Certainly we see sexual violence in countries where alcohol is prohibited at very high rates. But it does mean that that is their weapon of choice, and that's the way that victims become vulnerable to their advances, that they use hegemonic masculine norms. It's what all guys do. Did you hit that? They use that kind of social norm to their advantage. So it seems to blend in, although most people don't actually adhere to those norms. And they use tools of isolation. Both plying their victims with alcohol and then isolating them from a larger group or room into a room. We see those as very common trends among campus perpetrators.
Now, you work for UW-Madison, but I'm curious if the support systems are similar across the state. What resources are available to students if they are a victim to sexual assault?
Sure. So a couple of things. The White House put out notalone.gov, a great compendium of confidential victim resources on college campuses, including confidential campus-based victim advocates like we have at University Health Services, as well as community-based advocates like those at the local Rape Crisis Center domestic violence program. And so that's a great place for students to know they can get help. And then they should also know that there is an importance around whether or not that service is confidential. And campuses in an attempt to respond better to these crimes now get put on notice if a student is talking to their academic advisor or faculty member. That person has an obligation to share that information with campus officials if they're not a confidential source. And that's not always comfortable for survivors. And so we really encourage students to know about which options are confidential.
It's back to school season. Students are starting to move in. I know Madison has gotten a little bit busier now. The streets are bustling. What's your best advice to offer to first-time students on how to stay safe on campus?
That is a great question. One of the things I think that's important and crucial to being a UW-Madison Badger is having social responsibility. And so staying safe on campus relies upon bystanders to intervene in harmful situations and requires that individuals know what those harmful situations are. So coercive behavior, isolating behavior, hyper-adherence to the gender binary or hyper-masculinity, those are red flags, and so intervening in those either by saying like, hey, that's not a funny joke, or by quite literally seeing someone at a party being too drunk to even stand up, and yet there are three men trying to get her phone number or touching her, that's a situation that doesn't require anyone to be rescued. It just might require that students have a responsibility to interrupt and intervene in that situation. And that's really for the benefit of everyone.
Where can people learn more about some of those warning signs and what to do about them?
Sure. We have a great first-year ed program at UW-Madison called Tonight. It is a sexual assault and dating violence program. And the public can actually watch that program at uhs.wisc.edu/tonight. And if they scroll down, they can actually see that program. It speaks extensively about help for victims, reporting options, as well as some of those red flags I just mentioned.
Well, Carmen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Carmen Hotvedt is a violence prevention specialist with University Health Services at UW-Madison.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. The list of what makes Wisconsin special is endless. Writer Jill Sisson-Quinn tells us about why she thinks Wisconsin is Earth's most perfect place.
There is a perfect place on Earth. Shelter number 3 at Mosky Basin Campground in Isle Royale National Park. There, rock meets water like the sloped back of a dog in a play bow. This campsite will make you change your itinerary. At sunup, you will leave your pack in its shelter and opt for a day hike instead of moving on, so you can stay another night, wake another morning. The shelter's graffitied inner walls tell of moose sightings. In the woods nearby, you find a moose femur from a wolf kill that happened at this very spot, which you read about before coming. There are approximately 750 moose on this island of 206 square miles. You do the math and get excited. You walk 17 miles, eyes peeled. You see fresh tracks. You pass a pair of hikers that have just seen one lumbering off in the brush. You encounter a secluded swamp, what you perceive as perfect moose habitat. If you were a moose, you would hang out here. Your hiking companion suddenly embraces you. She has seen a moose. You peer in the direction of her finger, but she has already reneged. It was an illusion. Its rump a stump. Its rack a rock face. Back at Mosky Basin, someone has taken the small colored length of rope you strung beneath the eaves as a clothesline, but left all your other things, your ultralight tent, your expensive backpacking stove. You forgive them, imagining scenarios in which they really needed it, a sunken tow line, a broken boot. Your feet and calves are sore. Mother Nature has prepared a 2,903 cubic mile ice-cold foot bath for you. The water is more clear than the iron-tinged, salt-softened water that would fill your tub at home. You lie on your stomach, chin on hands, back to the lake, looking happily at the humble, three-sided hut where you will spend the night, only a thin, screened wall separating you from the forest. And that is when you see it. A tiny, fat, neon-green thing cruising across the rock. It's the kind of caterpillar you can understand a bird's desire for, plump like a ripe berry and green like a leafy vegetable and likely packed with protein. It is no doubt uncomfortable, bright and obstacle-free as its course is, for a keratin beak could snap it right up at any moment. It is a tobacco hornworm. You watch its persistent trek from one side of the curved rock face to the other, as if it were some sort of alien covering an entire hemisphere of a foreign planet. You have seen one before, at home, in your own woods, but with the energy that powers the solar system emanating down on you and up through you, it looks different. Your vision has become telescopic, your lens fine-tuned. You came to look for a moose, but you don't need a moose to sustain you. All you need is sun, water, stone, and something green and lovely. This caterpillar will be just fine, thank you very much.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is a nature writer and teacher in central Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik.
Wisconsin Life wants to know, what's your Wisconsin Life? Send us your home video that celebrates or showcases something you're passionate about. It can be a cell phone video, a minute or less, and we may post it on the Wisconsin Life Facebook page or even include it in one of our TV episodes. You can email your video to us at wisconsinlife@wpr.org.
Now, according to new research, we may now be able to put a price tag on the benefits of trees. According to research in the journal Environmental Pollution, the total annual value of pollution removal by U.S. trees is $86 billion. This includes areas like human health, building and material losses, and crop damage.
David Nowak is with us now. He's a project leader with the USDA Forest Service at the Northern Research Station in Syracuse, New York, and he helped conduct the new research. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Usually when we talk about trees, we're pretty vague. We say things like, getting out in nature is good for you. Now you have some details. Just how good are trees for us?
Well, trees provide numerous benefits for society. The one we looked at specifically in the paper was pollution removal and its effect on human health. But trees also reduce air temperature in cities. They provide wildlife habitat. They sequester carbon in terms of climate change. Reduce energy use around buildings. They have numerous benefits they provide for society.
Well,
What makes trees so effective in adding to human health and well-being?
Well, the process is basically when you have trees out in the environment, their leaves during the daytime are exchanging gases. It's like we breathe in and out. The trees are exchanging gases at the leaf level. As part of that process, the pollution goes inside the leaf if it's a gas pollutant, or if it's a small particle, it can impinge and stick on the outside of the leaf, and therefore it's taken out of the air. So if the plants are removing the pollution from the atmosphere, it's reducing concentrations of the pollution in the atmosphere, which that's where you get the impact on human health directly, is having reduced concentrations.
How much pollution do trees typically absorb?
An individual tree, up to maybe 6 or 7 pounds a year. Nationwide, we estimated about 17 million tons for the United States, which across the United States is about 35% tree cover. So it can vary. It's an issue of scale. The more trees or the more leaves you have, the greater the removal rate.
And still, it seems pretty significant. $86 billion is a large number. Does this mean we need to put trees into context and give them a lot more importance than we do?
Well, we should have a discussion on that, is that trees have an impact on the environment and on the people around the trees, that they shouldn't be discarded as having no value, or we should put together the negative parts of the trees. Trees do produce pollen. There are times when they can increase energy use, and there are costs associated with trees. We have to maintain them in urban areas. But there are also all these benefits. So if we're going to design cities or landscapes to help improve the environment, trees are one important element that needs to be part of the discussion.
Have you looked as closely as sort of translating the amount of pollution that is absorbed by trees and translating that into number of asthma cases prevented or something along those lines?
Well, we looked at human health. We looked at a bunch of different metrics. In terms of human mortality, we estimate nationwide about 850 lives per year being saved from the forests of the United States, and about 670,000 incidences of acute respiratory symptoms that are avoided due to having trees in the environment. There are other health benefits, such as increased work productivity, more people at work, school lost days are reduced because there are more people going to school because they're not unhealthy. I'm trying to look specifically for asthma, which is one of the attributes we looked at.
Well, we can come back to that, too.
Okay, thank you.
But that's a lot of benefits there being ascribed to trees. What do we know about how they contribute to, say, emotional well-being?
Well, our study's looking at that, too, that people who view vegetation become, there are physiological responses to viewing vegetation. The very scientists looking at that. The hormones of the bodies change, the alpha waves, the beta waves of the brains change. So we actually have physiological responses to viewing vegetation, which reduces stress, tends to boost our immune system. So we are attached, whether it be through clean air or through just viewing vegetation, but it does have impacts on human health.
So just looking at a tree can make you healthier?
That's what the studies are showing, that there are impacts for most people of viewing vegetation. Has, your body reacts to having less stress and improved immune system.
I imagine there might be some, what's the opposite of collateral damage, collateral benefits of trees? You know, instead of just looking at trees in a vacuum, we also think about the wildlife that lives within them. Does that have an additional impact on the positive influence of being around and near trees?
I would say, yes, there are many different, we call them externalities because they're external to the price of the product that you buy. All these positive benefits or externalities that come from the vegetation, wildlife being one of them. For the most part, depending on what the wildlife is and depending on who you are, it's not always the same thing. When you view vegetation, everybody's different. For the most part, people like wildlife, and wildlife's a positive attribute. Same thing with the human health attributes. So there are these externalities or collateral benefits that we get. And that's what we need to understand, is that if we make decisions about changing the landscape, we need to understand what these benefits that we're changing, that we may not necessarily think about when we clear the forest to do something with it, what are we losing in the process of doing that?
And is it true that urban trees are more important than rural trees? And what advice do you have for city planners with regards to that?
Well, we stated that within our paper in terms of human health impacts. It doesn't mean that urban trees overall, urban trees make up about 3% of the United States, where rural trees dominate because 97% of our land base is rural. But in terms of human health, the proximity of trees close to people is very important in terms of reducing the concentration. So if I have a forest that's cleaning the air and no one lives in the forest, there's no one receiving the benefits. If I put a forest in Manhattan where there's high concentrations of people, the greater the impact the tree has on the population. Therefore, we want the trees in proximity to people to produce those health benefits.
And in terms of deforestation, what evidence is there that, you know, you take away the trees and people start to get sick?
Well, that's the hard thing to show. We did it through computer modeling showing that we know that trees remove pollution. We know that reduced concentrations. We know that trees remove pollution. We know reduced pollution reduces concentration. We know reduced concentrations impact health. We've combined that all together, modeling each county of the United States. The problem with trying to show that directly by saying if we deforest an area, that has an impact on health. There's many other things that are going on with deforesting. It's hard to make the cause and effect directly to the impact of reducing the forest. There are other factors that go on to it at the same time.
What further research do you think needs to be done to understand the true impact that trees have on us?
Well, there's a whole bunch of research that needs to be done. I think we look at more in depth about the local scale issues about having trees, because trees will not always reduce concentrations. There are times when you put trees near roadways, and if you canopy over a roadway and have the car driving underneath that canopy, you can actually increase concentrations locally near street sides. A lot of trees are removing pollutants. They're not allowing the pollutants to disperse. So that would tend to increase concentration near the sidewalk. So those are important things to look at in terms of design. Well, the thing you mentioned about viewing vegetation and these health responses that we have by seeing vegetation or how they help form social communities, there's a whole bunch of research being done on that. That's an important area to look at. Many attributes related to human health are very important that we're just beginning to hit the tip of the iceberg here of what might be there.
Well, David, as a forester, you obviously care deeply about trees and some of the stuff that, you know, we could say you can't really put into a scientific report like this. What do you want people to know about why we should love trees and care for them?
Well, trees provide many benefits to society. And people, I think, inherently appreciate trees for the aesthetic value. And if we live around forests, there are many things that they're doing. They're basically workhorses that are champions out there cleaning the air, moving gases, and providing physical cleansing, chemistry changes, and physiological changes to our body that we may not understand or appreciate until they're gone. So that the idea now is if you're going to do this, understand the many attributes about what the forest does for you so we can make informed decisions for the future.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
David Nowak is a project leader with the USDA Forest Service at the Northern Research Station in Syracuse, New York, and he helped conduct the new research about the health benefits of trees.